Can you imagine if he had a tail and he got killed first? Yeah. I would be lynched by my community.
What's up, everybody? This is Karen Mahorn, a.k.a. The Blurred Girl, and welcome to the Blurred Girl Podcast. Now, I have to apologize for the fact that this episode is going up a little later than I wanted it to, but I appreciate your patience. Now, this week, my guest is director and producer Hanalee Culpepper. Now, Hanalee is an accomplished director in her own right. In fact, she's directed several TV. She's been in TV for years, basically. She's done plenty of action and genre stuff like Sleepy Hollow, Supergirl, and The Flash. But Hanalee has been thrust into the spotlight over the past month because she directed the pilot episode of Picard, the new series on CBS All Access that brought back Patrick Stewart into the role of Jean-Luc Picard, the captain of the Enterprise from Star Trek Next Generation. Now, what makes it even more significant is the fact that she is actually the first woman to ever direct a Star Trek pilot in the history of the franchise. And of course, by extension, the first Black woman as well. But that's not the only thing I talk about this episode. It's been a really, really busy week. Not only did Marvel's Voices number one, the comic, drop this week, but there was a launch party. There were more Black History Month events going on. And Sci-Fi actually, I don't think they know what they did, but they actually let me host a full episode of Who Won the Week on my own. And what I do, I turned around and made it the blackest thing ever. I had so much fun this week. And I'll tell you why right after we pay some bills. If you've been following me for any length of time, then you know I stay busy and it's really hard for me to get in all the reading that I want to do. So that's why I'm a huge fan of audiobooks from Audible. And if you use my special code, audibletrial.com/theblurredgirl, you can get a free subscription. Now I listen to them when I'm cleaning the house, traveling. They're especially great for passing the time on those long lines at the airport. Now currently I'm listening to Akata Witch for three reasons. One, I'm a fan of Nnedi Okorafor's writing. She writes incredible science fiction featuring African women. Two, it's been dubbed the Nigerian Harry Potter. And three, because Yetide Badaki, who was just on the show recently, is narrating it. Now, what I love about audiobooks like this is that, kind of like scripted podcasts, they are like listening to old-time radio programs, and I love that. But don't take my word for it. Start your own commitment-free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/theblurredgirl. You can choose from one audiobook and two Audible originals you can't hear anywhere else. Also, any credits that you don't use totally roll over to the next month. So start your 30-day free trial today by going to audibletrial.com/theblurredgirl. Now, back to the show. Hey there. Now, before I forget, please consider subscribing to the Blurred Girl Podcast and leaving me a rating and a comment over on iTunes. It really helps the show out. It really does. And if you're feeling extra helpful, I'd really love it if you could screenshot this episode and tag the Blurred Girl over on IG Stories in a post telling me what you think. Now, that last part doesn't really help my numbers, but it does help me feel better about myself. And some days I need that. I'll be honest. So let's talk news. The launch party this week for Marvel's Voices number one happened, and I was stunned at the turnout. We had a blast over at NE1 Comics here in Brooklyn. And shout out to Angelique Roche, who worked really hard to put it together, along with Demetrius, the store's owner. And if you're in Brooklyn and you want to get comics, NE1 Comics is your stop. Everyone was there. Tatiana King-Jones from For All Nerds, Kyra Randolph, Letha Martinez. It was her birthday, actually. There was cake. Damian Scott, Regine Sawyer, and so many other artists and creatives and fans that helped, you know, make the night a success. So if you haven't picked it up yet, please buy Marvel Voices today or request it at your comic book shop. Now, also related to Marvel's Voices, I have an article up on Marvel.com about the legacy of Isaiah Bradley. He is a Black Captain America, and as well as his son, Josiah, and his grandson, Elijah. So if you think Sam Wilson was the only Black Captain America, you would be wrong. And I talk about their history over at Marvel, and I will link that in the show notes as well. Also this week, I got a chance to take over Sci-Fi Wire's Who Won the Week podcast because Adam was out recovering from knee surgery. And so I just kept the party going and I had Angelique and Kwanzaa Asajifo, who is the co-creator of the comic book Black and one of the creative architects of the H1 imprint over at Humanoids. I had the two of them co-host with me. Here's a taste of what that was like.
Yo, somebody came in my house once upon a time and you know who you are. And you picked up my Kirby Black Panther. And I was like, who told you you could touch the oldest comic book in my house?
You see, this is why I don't have company.
Who told you?
No, seriously.
And their answer was, I didn't take it out of the plastic. And I looked at them and I said, but you were going to.
Nope, this is why I don't have company.
That's just no home training.
That's what I'm
None.
Saying. You know, it's like
do
walking
you have a
into
mom?
Exactly. Don't you hate like when people walk in your house and just open your fridge without asking?
Oh.
No.
Mm-mm.
You got it. There's at least Mm-mm. a 3 to 4 visit rule before you start opening up stuff
nope.
in my house.
Also, that's an immediate ejection from the house and maybe a question of our friendship. It's just like,
yeah.
oh, you have
Shoot.
To leave right now.
That's
right.
like going into
first
like,
your shoes
a
are
plastic.
On, second you're in my fridge.
Well, and it's akin to like opening up one of your like value cases that's got the actual like appraisement on it that says 9.8. No, why are you touching that comment?
No, it's like touching my hair. No.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah.
No. So yeah, it was the blackest episode of a podcast Sci-Fi Wire has ever done. And they might not let us do it again. So please listen to that as well. I will link in the show notes. Now, finally, Monday, February 24th, the Radical Geeks got passes to see the first episode of season 2 of Altered Carbon, starring Anthony Mackie. Speaking of Captain America. Now, since the Radical Geeks hasn't had a podcast and an episode in a while. I know, we're working on it. So if you're in New York on Monday, February 24th and want to see a screening of the premiere live, Netflix has a screening at the AMC Empire Theater here in New York starting at 8 p.m. You need passes. I will leave that link in the show notes. But even with the passes, you must get there early, okay? And there's not that many passes left. So hurry. And don't forget, next month, I'm going to be at Ace Comic Con Northeast from March 20th to 22nd in Boston. I will be hosting on the live stage again. I don't know whom I'm going to be talking to, but I will be talking to one of the following people. Chris Evans, Tom Hiddleston, Ewan McGregor, Shameik Moore, Hayden Christensen, or Tessa Thompson. Now, speaking of Tessa, did you see the season 3 trailer for Westworld? Because my God. And I really need to at some point talk to Tandy Newton because she's everything. And she's also ageless. I need her secrets. So if you're coming to Boston, head over to acecomiccon.com and buy tickets. I believe they've already started taking money for the photo ops too. So hurry. Now, today's interview guest is Hannah Lee Culpepper. She is now famous for being the first woman to direct a pilot for a Star Trek episode in the entire history of the franchise. But that is not the only Star Trek episode she's directed. Now, last season, she directed the Red Angel episode on Discovery. Remember that? When it was revealed who the Red Angel was. I won't spoil it. And we got Michael's history with her family and everything. It was great. She's also directed other sci-fi shows, namely the CW's Flash, Supergirl. If you remember Sleepy Hollow, she's also directed episodes of that. She was also a huge Star Trek Next Generation fan long before she got a chance to direct the franchise. So what's amazing about this episode is that she really breaks down what it takes to direct in Hollywood and also directing a show like this. So if you are studying to be a director, or if you are studying to be a producer, or you know anybody in film school, they should be listening to this podcast because this episode, she really breaks down what a day on set is actually like. She also talks about what it's like working with Patrick Stewart. And yes, I asked her the question a lot of you were asking me, and that was, did a black man or a black boy, I should say, have to be the first person to die in the series? And she does have an answer for that, and it's not what you think. So you definitely need to listen to this episode to get the full scoop before you start canceling people on Twitter. So up next, my interview with director and producer, Hannah Lee Culpepper. Welcome, Hannah Lee. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Pleasure. My fellow blurred.
Yes. And I'm just, even though everybody is talking about Picard, as they should, and congratulations on being the first woman to basically direct a Star Trek pilot, which I didn't realize because I'm always very shocked when I have the, hey, It's 2020 right. and we're still saying first. but it is not your first time directing. You have been in the business for a minute. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the things that you've directed and produced before?
Sure. I've done a variety of stuff. I've done other sci-fi superhero stuff like The Flash and Supergirl, genre stuff like Sleepy Hollow. My first feature was a supernatural thriller, It's Within. I've also done some character drama work like Parenthood and The Crossing, 10 Days in the Valley, and some really like grounded sci-fi thriller called Counterpart, which sadly has been canceled. It was such an amazing show.
What was your first big break? I'm assuming you went to film school, but even if you didn't, what do you consider your first big break as a director and or producer?
So I did not go to film school, but I consider my first big break probably to be when I got the green light to do my first feature. I think I have to say that, because it's actually really so hard to get a feature off the ground, and that one came mm-hmm. together somewhat easily. Actually, I'm going to go back even further. I think my big break started when I got in AFI's directing workshop for women, because that gave mm-hmm. me more confidence as a director. It put something, a good cachet on my resume. In the short that I did through that program, went and did many festivals. That's what led me to meet the writer of it then. So I'm going to say AFI's directing workshop for women was the first big break.
Right, and it sort of opened doors and created opportunities,
right.
It sounds like.
Right, and it's so interesting because, I'm glad you asked that as what is the first, because there have been other big breaks since then. Like, there's no one mm-hmm. thing that opened the door for all my, for every opportunity in my career. It's almost like that one big break then led to more stepping stones to the next big break, which led to more stepping stones to the next big break.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, it's funny. I just had April Rain on the podcast and we were talking about, Oscar so white again.
Mm-hmm.
And just how difficult it is for people of color, specifically women of color, to get access. And then the one or two that do, that's all they let in. You mentioned the AFI, but do things like Oscars and Emmys, do they mean anything anymore? If it's, in terms of like, quote unquote, the old boys network is still at play, do they really have the same meaning, or really is it about the work?
I think it's really about the work. They do still have meaning, at least for me. I would love to be nominated for an Oscar or an Emmy because it shows that the industry recognizes the work that you've done. But obviously, there's only so many people who can get nominated and win. And there's a lot of other people who are doing great work who don't have those accolades behind them. So I say it matters, but that shouldn't be what we're constantly striving for. You should just be striving to do great work that will hopefully get recognized.
Now let's pivot to Star Trek a little bit, because that's what we're here for. Now, I heard from fans, actually, that you were a bit of a Star Trek fan even before you directed Discovery. I first saw the Red Angel episode that you directed, and we'll get there. But I want to know, my listeners are geeks. What Star Trek was your favorite? What were you geeking out over before you started directing for the franchise?
The Next Generation was my favorite Star Trek, and that's the one that made me a true fan. That's the one that I looked forward to every week. And I really loved Picard and his family, his crew, which was his family. Loved Data and Riker and Worf. And so that's what I kind of geeked out over, were those guys and that specific series, The Next Generation.
Gotcha. I was a Deep Space Nine fan.
Mm-hmm.
Cisco had no tolerance for nonsense.
Yeah, I think it all kind of depends on the age you are when you're introduced to them, Because
mm-hmm.
the people who are older than me, they tend to lean towards the original series.
Yeah.
My age, it tends to be the Next Generation.
It must have been sort of a dream come true when you got asked to direct an episode of Discovery. Let's talk about the Red Angel episode. But first of all, that episode, or actually that those two or three episodes in season two, were some of my favorite. They were some of the most gorgeous. So kudos to you for doing such an amazing job and working with such an amazing team. What was it like when you got that call that you were going to be working on Star Trek coming back?
Yeah, I remember that. I was quite excited when my agents called me about it. And I assumed, oh, I need to go have some meetings about it. And they're like, nope, they want to offer you an episode. And so it was totally thrilling. And it just all came about because the producing director, Olutunde, had seen my work on Sleepy Hollow. I met him way back when he was shooting Sleepy Hollow and I was prepping. And he just was really impressed and wanted to work with me. So I was honored even back then to be asked to join the Star Trek family.
Discovery just had such a, even the look of it, Discovery had a very dark look to it. Mm-hmm. And Picard mm-hmm. is very bright. I think because it was on the ship so much, or ships, it was very confining. But the Red Angel, we're on a planet and it was open. It was mm-hmm. wide, a little bit more wide space. Did you request that? Did you make, you know, requests of the production designers to make it feel really, really wide open? Or was that just always scripted in?
No, I did not request that. It was... the location that we found was awesome, and so that was why we shot there. And they had used that location for other things. Mm-hmm. So when I came on board, they had already pre-scouted it and felt that it would work really well. And I agreed with them because it's nice to be off the ship, and it had all this great architecture and depth to it. And it was just a cool-looking building. So that's how that happened. The script didn't necessarily say that this should be XYZ. It basically said that, you know, they're on this plan and describe what it looked like. Excuse me. And then ultimately then the production designer, the director, and the producing director go and find what can work and fulfill that vision. And so that space, it just was one that they used before. It's close to the stages, and it was just a cool choice. It's not the easiest place to shoot in. There's no... obviously, you can probably tell there's mm-hmm. there's no protection from the weather. So if it rained, it got wet in there. If it snowed, you got snow in there.
But oh, wow.
Such a lovely place to shoot photographs beautifully.
Yeah, it was stunning.
I remember do feeling because my first episode was completely on the ship. And so I remember when I got the script, I was excited that I actually got to shoot off of one of our standing stages and go to a location for a change.
When it comes to Picard, you not only directed the pilot, but you're also, I believe, for the first three episodes served as one of the executive producers. Is that correct?
Yes, co-executive producer.
Is it challenging wearing both those hats?
No, because the bulk of my job is as a director. The co-executive producer credit acknowledges the depth of the contribution you made to creatively to the show, and the fact that you are a part of really setting the tone and the look and the characters from the very get-go. And so it was not too hard to wear both of those hats because it's kind of so integrated anyway. And what you're doing.
And let's explore that just for a moment just in layman's terms for people who might not realize all the work that a director does. The script already exists when you get it. Now, do you get a chance to adjust the script at all based on the location? Or I know Patrick Stewart has a lot of say in the show. Does he improv? You know, are there changes that you mm-hmm. get to make on set?
Mm-hmm. We didn't do much improv. We get the script and Patrick Stewart gives his note to the writers. I may bring up some notes to them, some suggestions, and then they can decide what they would like to do or not do. We tend not to just improv on the set. If there's an issue that comes up when we're doing our first rehearsal, then we work it out with the writer then so that the writer will adjust the language, the dialogue, and then we'll do it as per the new script once we start shooting. We do sometimes need to adjust things because of locations or perhaps there's something with the blocking that just makes it not work. And again, it's always just discussions with the writers. about it. We also had to be careful, though. One reason you cannot improv on a show like Star Trek is because there's so many, there's canon to be, that you need to be true to, but also there's things that the writers have put in because it's setting up things that happen later. And because none of us who are actually shooting know the whole season, where we don't know where the storylines are going. Patrick Stewart knows some of it because he's in those intimate conversations, but he doesn't know everything because ultimately he can't be in the writer's room 100% of the time. And they know everything that's going to happen for all the future episodes. So something that might not make any sense to us or may not mean much to us may be an important thing for later on. So that's why we don't improv.
Is there somebody on set whose job it is to make sure that everything stays canon? Or is that more in the writer's room?
There's always a writer represented on set. It's either the showrunner or one of his other people. They just kind of decided who would be able to do it. So that person is there to just kind of make sure, to keep an eye on things. I don't think that person, at the point at which we're shooting, there's not so much worry about canon mm-hmm. anymore. All of that happened in our pre-production process as we are selecting what we're going to, how we're going to shoot it, what props, you know, anything. That is when that person can bring up, well, in episode blah blah, this was how we did it, or it says, so once we start shooting, we're kind of not as worried about that. We've worked it all out. Mm-hmm. But of course there's things that come up. So that's why you always would have at least one writer represented on set.
Now let's talk locations for a minute. It seems like you have multiple locations. You've got the vineyard, you've got the Borg cube, you've got inside the house, you've got also sort of Starfleet Command. But what for you was the most challenging location in the first three or four episodes here for you to shoot on?
Oh, that's an easy question to answer. The most challenging location was the Anaheim Convention Center.
Really?
Absolutely, hands down. Because, well, we had been looking all over for what's going to be the exterior of Starfleet, because it had to mm-hmm. feel special, right? And a lot of the other places we were looking at, you know, Los Angeles actually doesn't have a ton mm-hmm. of cool buildings. We have some, but we don't have a ton, or that feel kind of unique. And so when I saw that one, which was one of the last ones we saw, because it was so far from our production office. It's truly a huge commute to go down there from the production office. But when I saw that and stood in front of it, where I basically have Picard standing in front of it, I was like, okay, this feels like Starfleet. It feels majestic and powerful, and they can add to it. And I knew that this is where I wanted to shoot. So then became the, if we're going to shoot here, what else can we shoot in this location? Because the more scenes we can knock off, like you said, there are a lot of locations. So the more of those we can knock off in one place, the better. So as we walked around, we realized, oh, this could be good for walking to the archives. This could work for the rooftop fight. This can work for the outside of the exterior of the archives. And this can work for Starfleet. We saw a part that could work for Clancy's office. It was, you know, there were all kinds of goodies there. And then we had to work out, okay, time-wise, if we only have this many days, what should we keep here, and then what should we come up with a plan B for? So Clancy's office ended up moving to another location because we didn't have enough time to shoot that and everything else I wanted to shoot there. So then we worked all that out, which took multiple drives, all the production office to Anaheim. And I'm telling you, that probably was like at least an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes every time we did that trek. So working out where I'm going to shoot it, going back again to block it, going back again to show people. And then meantime, the location manager is working with the site reps to figure out what days can we do it. And that was a puzzle. And then finally, it like all came together. We knew the days we could be there and have all the space. Everything was worked out. I had it all blocked out. It was time for the tech scout. And the tech scout is when you go with all your department heads. So you show up there with about 50 other people. And you tell them, this is what we're going to shoot here. We're going to look this way, so they know where they can safely put trucks and mm-hmm. and catering and, you know, every other thing that needs to happen, where the generator is going to go, where light sources are going to go, et cetera, et cetera. So we show up for that, and that is when they tell us, oh, actually, there's going to be a convention for 5,000 people. over in this area. Oh, yeah, and then they're going to want to walk through that area. Oh, yeah, now there's going to be a group that's setting up for something in this area starting at 12. Oh, and then this is going to happen here. And it was just like we had been working with them so hard to find 2 days when they were supposed to be empty
right,
and we could control the place. And that's what we had on the books. And then I show up, and they're like, no, actually, there's all this happening. I don't know where the breakdown happened. And the producers were kind of like, I think we have to shoot someplace else. And I'm just like, no. So then it became the AD and I figuring out, okay, we can shoot this direction until this time and then run inside and turn around. But then I won't be able to look back in that direction because then they're going to start setting up that stuff and we won't be able to see that. I mean, we, you know, it's one thing
wow.
if we're just shooting a normal day thing. But we couldn't have, like, people in regular street clothes just come wandering through the set.
Right.
And it was like, I was going to shoot all of this one scene on this one part, but because of the 5,000 people were going to start coming through and the music I was going to start blasting, I had to cut that scene in two and then plan a move to another part to make it all work. So it was, like, it was running through that. And ultimately, we did it. We got everything, and it looks great, but I just know, like, I have the list in my head of the stuff I was not able to shoot because we mm-hmm. just didn't have the time. But ultimately, I'm glad that we stuck to that location because I think visually everything that we shot there looked stunning.
It did. They looked amazing. Now, you also mentioned the fight scenes on the roof. There's a, mm-hmm. a bunch of different fight scenes, even episode 3. Mm-hmm. He's got the right Romulans in his house. How difficult is it shooting some of these fight scenes as opposed to some of the dialogue stuff, whether or not you're directly directing it or, you know, overseeing second unit as a producer?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I enjoy shooting fight scenes, so it's difficult in that there's a lot to that. I like to shoot a lot of stuff, so you mm-hmm. want to make sure you get all the beats. Probably the most challenging part of the fight sequences is that I wanted Dodge's fight to feel very different from Lars's and Jaban's fight. Dodge is a little bit superhuman, and so I asked him to come with moves that feel not like something just you and I could just do. And then with mm-hmm. with Jaban and Lars, it had to feel like they were skilled assassins, the military. They had a little bit more, and I wanted it to feel a little bit more raw and gritty and violent.
Yeah, it looked more like a Krav Maga. It looked like very close quarters
right.
kind of fighting.
Yeah. And I shot them very differently as well, so they could feel differently. So I think most of the challenges in the planning, and then when you get to it, it's just about, again, it's always that time, right? Mm-hmm. So when I shot the fight with her and when her boyfriend is killed, there was a couple more setups that I wish I had gotten, though ultimately when I look at that cut together, we totally don't need them. It works very well as is. That's probably always, yeah. So once you design it and work it out, it's just about having the time to shoot it. And then making sure you pick and choose what's most important, because ultimately some stuff comes off your shot list.
Yeah.
It's so funny. I turn in my shot list to the ADs and the DP. I always send it to them the night before. And they just come in, like, looking at me like, are you crazy? All these shots in your shot list? And I actually, I don't even call it a shot list anymore. I call it a shot guide, because it's a fluid document that changes as your actors feel like they don't want to move a certain way, or something comes up with a location, or you figure out something better, or the camera operator or DP have a better idea. So I actually always call them a shot guide, not a shot list. So I tell them, don't worry, I know there are a lot of shots. I know that I will be evaluating and whittling down as we're going along, including adding some shots sometimes.
The execution of it looks so amazing that we could not tell that you were going through all those headaches behind the scenes. I just have this image of, like, you yelling cut and, like, people off scene screaming and yelling at people like, stop moving, stop talking, stop, you know.
Yes, believe me, if there's any scene in a public place, imagine a whole bunch of PAs off camera holding back, you know, people with strollers and bicycles and getting fussed at and evil eyes.
Yeah.
at them because they want to go about their day.
It's like herding cats, I'm sure. One of the things that you just mentioned was like one of those early fight scenes with Daju's boyfriend that was killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you about that scene just really quick. Some of the fans reacted to it kind of adversely. They were frustrated because they felt like, oh my God, the brother's first to die again.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that he's an alien, but I wanted to ask you about that because I know in Discovery, when we lost Wilson Cruz, he came back.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask you, like, is he coming back or is he gone for good?
I can't answer that question because I can't answer anything that hasn't aired. But I would love to address that question because it frustrates me a lot that people are upset about that. Or I should say some people are upset about that because, A, I think the kill the black man off first trope in horror movies is very different than what happened in my scene. I feel like in horror movies, it's kind of just like, let's get to the killing and, you know, and it's just kind of dispense of him sort of way. And for me, I feel like his death was such an emotional punch. It was gut-wrenching. It was tragic. I found it really sad. But going beyond that, so I think because of that, that's one reason that for me it never even crossed my mind that it could be considered one of those tropes. But originally, this scene was originally in the script, and we had cast a white guy to play the role. And he was going to be an alien that had a tail. And then as we were working out our schedules and figuring out things, that scene got cut because we didn't have the time to shoot it in our initial schedule. And we felt like potentially you didn't need it. And then once we saw the cut, the writers and I felt like we wanted that scene back. And I always missed that scene when it was cut. So I was very excited when it came back. When it came, once we were able to shoot it, which was going to be 2 months later, because I initially was shooting in April and May, and I think I shot that in July, the actor we had originally cast for the role was not available. And in the meantime, with all of our roles, we were inclusive casting. We saw, you know, the actors of all races for just about everything, I believe. And I felt like I didn't have enough black men in the show. And so I was like, oh, here's my chance to bring in a black man for this role, and especially since the guy we were originally using is unavailable. And then I just said, we just can't have a tail. I'm not putting a tail on a black man. So they changed him to be a different.
That I will tell you, I'm sorry to cut you off, but that I will tell you was a very good decision because putting a tail on a black man would definitely have gotten you.
Yeah. Can you imagine if he had a tail and he got killed first?
Again.
I would be lynched by my community.
So that was a good call.
They changed him. They changed him to another alien, Zahian, which I thought was great because it tied into Discovery. And at that point, you know, I didn't even think about the fact that he's going to die first because since that scene was out of the picture for a while, Dodge was the first person who was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, it was just I wanted to be inclusive. And it wasn't just it wasn't a horror movie. It was an emotional thing. And so there you go. That's how it happened that black man happened to be killed first in Picard. And I still believe that I think it's better to be inclusive than to make every decision based on, you know, oh, he's going to be killed first. Okay, then I'm not going to put a black person in that role. I feel like we can't make the decision that way. If it's just a gratuitous killing, then yeah, maybe think about that. But for someone who, for me, was the emotional heart of Dodge, I don't mind putting that he happened to be killed first.
And we're going to see other black men, I'm assuming, cast in the show.
Right.
Okay.
Yes, we will.
He can't possibly
really
be the other.
We tried to get some black men in other substantial roles, and people were just not available. It was kind of amazing. We black men and black women. of a certain age, they are out there working. So that was actually kind of a cool thing to know that so many of the black actors were too busy to do it.
Many actors sometimes say that their own agents aren't sending them out for things. And if especially if they are one of the few people of color on a roster, they're not being sent out for stuff, and they'll find out much later and like, hey, why did you put me up for
well,
that?
That's probably true, because I do know of two instances of people that I reached out to, had to reach out to personally, because their agents, and it wasn't, I don't even necessarily know if it's related to race or anything, it was just that the agent felt that the role was too small for them, and so they did not submit them. And so it's only by me reaching out to them that they even knew that we had tried to bring them in.
Let's talk about the characters. What did you think about bringing the Zatvash into this story? And, you know, the Romulans, and what was your favorite callback to Next Generation?
I thought bringing in Zatvash was very cool. I love that we're going deeper into what it means to be Romulan. And my favorite callback was the Captain Picard poster in the archives. That was one of my favorite moments. I still remember how kind of cranky he was going through all the things the kids had made. Mm-hmm. And then he comes into this room, which contains the things that he feels are so special that they have to be specially held, right? And that poster, he could have just folded up and put in a closet or something, but no, it's in the archives. So it just shows how much he has changed since we saw him in The Next Generation.
What was one of the things that you were worried about when you found out, like, of course you were elated that you got Picard, but what were one of the things that you were worried about with bringing Picard into 2020?
I just wanted to make sure I did a great job. It was unacceptable to me to do anything less than an A job. Picard is too special. The Next Generation is too special to the fans. The opportunity that was offered to me was too great. You know, talk about a life-changing moment, a career-changing moment. Being offered to do this was that. And so that was my main worry, to always show up every day and earn an A. That's what I wanted to do. As far as how I shot it, my approach, always being grounded in character and in emotion and in truth, but still delivering something that is visually interesting and exciting was my, you know, that was the goal.
Awesome. Now, some of my last few questions here are going to be from fans, because when I told people that I was interviewing you, as you saw, Twitter kind of blew up. What helped to affect your decision to change the color palettes for this show? Was that a decision that specifically you and your DP made? Because I feel like Picard is so warm and Discovery is so cool. Was that on purpose? Mm-hmm. Was that on purpose?
That was on purpose, yes. That was my choice. When I pitched the look to Alex Kurtzman and the Secret Hideout team, I said I very much wanted this show to feel different from Discovery. I wanted it to be its own show and not feel like a spinoff of Discovery. And so I very purposely chose to do warm colors. And also just in looking at my inspiration, looking at pictures of vineyards and stuff, they take on this wonderful hue in the sunset or while the grapes are ripening, and you see all the oranges and the reds and as well as the, you know, the green. And so, and also felt like Picard's kind of in, you know, I don't want to say the sunset of his life, almost a sunset and a sunrise, right?
Right.
He's at a time of a reflection of what he's done, but he also is going to get this mission and rise again. So warm just felt right, and fall colors just felt right for where he was, and it was very different from Discovery. If Discovery had been a warm show, then maybe I would have gone cool
with this one. Yeah.
But fortunately, it's not, because I feel like warm is the correct color palette for Picard.
Well, also the fact that Discovery was so cool on so many levels, but cool in terms of the color temperature. I think when you did the Red Angel, the red popped so much more. Because we were so used to, even though it was a cool red, we were just so used to seeing all the blue and the steel that the red is, would just, you know, really, really jumped out at us. Somebody else has asked, who are some of the directors that have mentored you or who you admire?
I love Frank Darabont. I love Danny Boyle. Mimi Leader, Catherine Bigelow. Yeah, I always want to say Catherine Hardwick, but no, Catherine Bigelow. By the way, Catherine Bigelow, even way before she did these amazing movies that she's done recently, she did Strange Days. She's one of the action stuff. And Mimi Leader as well. They were some of the few women doing action movies back then. So that's why they were women that I was kind of admiring and looking up to as well.
Yeah. And then one of my last questions from the fans are, how do you pick and choose your projects? You and your agent are sent tons of scripts. How do you pick what you're going to do?
It just has to grab me emotionally and also has to inspire me for what it looks like are the key things for me.
What are the things that you, not just as a director, but sort of as a Star Trek fan, looking forward to the most?
I just look forward to continuing the journey with him. You know, obviously I know what happened in the first three and I've read the scripts for a lot of the others, but I haven't seen how the directors did it. I haven't seen how Picard acted it or how Patrick Stewart, but I didn't see how Patrick Stewart performed it. That's how I should have said it. So for me, I'm just looking forward to continuing the story. I'm really curious to see what happens. I'm very curious to see how he ends up coming together with Soji and what is the whole secret behind it all. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
What is it like working with Patrick Stewart? What was it like your first, I'm sure you had a table read or a meeting before you directed him, but what was it like that first time you met him? And what was it like the first day of directing with Patrick Stewart?
The first time I met him was over the phone when I was still in the interview phase, and I was so immediately impressed and taken in by him because he's such a kind person. And he was so very happy to be stepping into these shoes again, and had lots of great thoughts on what we were going to do to honor Picard and who he was and who he is. And the first time I directed him, I guess, would be the rehearsal. And I was very nervous. And because you have to, you know, I'm like, if you're going to go work with Patrick Stewart, you have to come in with your A game. Mm-hmm. And so I found myself reviewing like all my theater notes and theater notes and rehearsal notes from the classes I've taken. And I come from a theater world, so rehearsal plans and all that stuff. I spent a lot of time preparing for that first rehearsal. And it was just exciting to be in the room with him and to see how he makes the words on the page even better than what they are, the respect that he elicits from the other actors, how they all came in and stepped, you know, with their A game to work with him. So I felt like the rehearsal went very well. And then later on that day, I got an email from Patrick Stewart saying he wanted to talk to me the next day of rehearsal. And I was a nervous wreck for the whole night. And I felt like the kid whose dad said, I'm going to talk to you when I get home. And the next day when I saw Patrick Stewart, he just basically had a comment on something that he wanted to do a little differently than how we had planned to do it in the rehearsal. And so I was just like, okay. I thought I was going to be like, you know, Honolulu, you don't know how to do a rehearsal.
Right.
I was waiting for the reprimand. But it was, he wanted to change something around that we had planned. So that was good. But that was my first experience working with him as a director.
Yeah, so he sent you this email and you're thinking you're in trouble and he just wanted to tell you before he forgot.
Yes, exactly. He just wanted to see if it was okay if we did something a little differently that we had planned for the blocking. And I was like, yeah, that's fine. If only he knew. Yes, totally, I'll do that.
If you had to give advice to anybody out there that's trying to do what you do, what would it be?
It would be A, do it. You know, go out and direct so that when you get that opportunity, you are ready and to grab it. And don't give up. It takes years. It takes a lot of rejection. It takes a thick skin before you get those opportunities. And they can really wear you down. And it's easy to say, don't give up. That's hard to do. I know, because I've been there. It helps if you have your cheerleader when you can go to that person. And when you say, I'm ready to give it all up, they keep you going. So have that person and find your mentor, the person who can kind of help guide you as you make the numerous decisions that you need to make along the way as far as the movement of your career.
Thank you so much. Can you share what you're working? Can you share what you're working on next?
Yeah, I'm about to do another pilot. So that's going to be on a CW. So they can look out for that. And then I am going to do a feature and hopefully we'll be shooting that in the fall.
Awesome. Well, you got to let us know on social what you're doing so we can all yell about it. And just to let you know, the majority of the Twitter comments I got for you were, oh my God, how awesome is that? We are so proud. I'm so happy to see that. She's amazing. These episodes look amazing. So,
my official thank you to all of your listeners, and thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely. I really, really appreciate it. And I'm so glad we were able to finally make it work. That was a class, right? That was a film class. Now, although Hanalei should clearly be credited as the first woman to direct a Star Trek pilot, at the same time, I'm like, it's 2020, people. We shouldn't still be saying the first woman, the first black woman, you know. But I'm more concerned with the fact that she's not the last. That's important to me. Let me know what you think in the comments. And speaking of commenting, please comment and subscribe. Go over to iTunes and leave me the comments there. Leave me a rating also. And tell me what else you'd like to hear on this podcast. Please also check out my podcast sponsor, Audible. And if you would like your own Audible subscription, you can get a free subscription today by going to audibletrial.com/theblurredgirl. That's audibletrial.com/theblurredgirl. Thanks for listening, folks. I will see you next week.